Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. For Megan Horst and her husband, Christian, there was life before February 23rd, 2012. And then there was life after. Megan writes about what happened in her essay, Are You My Husband? It's read by Renee Elise Goldsberry. Renee won a Tony Award for her role in the hit musical Hamilton. She's starring now in the movie Waves, currently in theaters.
Recently, I found myself on the receiving end of a tarot card reading at a summer potluck. A woman I had met only 30 minutes earlier peered at me over her glasses. The cards spread out on a cooler between us. Holding the Five of Pentacles, she said, Have you grieved the loss of your husband? The directness of the question from a stranger shook me, especially since my husband was still very much alive, less than 3 miles away in our house. Yet it was not the first time this had come up. Various people, from my stepmother-in-law to my therapist, have said something along the lines of, I think you need to grieve the loss of your husband. My chiropractor said, Something is stuck inside of you. You need to let it out. That something, she suggested, was grief. This may have been good advice, but it's not easy to implement when you still text your husband the grocery list, negotiate holiday family visits, and sleep in the same bed. Christian and I met in our mid-20s on the first day of graduate school orientation at the University of Washington. According to his retelling, he had chosen me to pursue after evaluating the full roster of single women in our entering class. A few days later, we found ourselves unlocking our bicycles next to one another at the rack outside of our department building. He offered to bike home with me. Our biking friendship quickly turned to romance. 5 years later, in our early 30s, we married in a ceremony in a mountain town outside of Seattle, exchanging a kiss, rings, and a vow to provide a hand to hold in yours through each tomorrow. 18 months after saying those words, I got one of those calls you dread. Actually, it was a series of urgent texts from his sister, brother, and stepmother, each saying, Call me. When I reached his stepmother, I learned that Christian was in the emergency room at the trauma hospital. He had flipped over his bike handles and was on life support. Christian remained in a coma for more than 3 weeks with a tracheotomy tube and a feeding tube. He was in a teaching hospital, so teams of doctors would come to check on him and evaluate his tests. It was early in that process that I learned, as they pored over grainy scans, that Christian had sustained a traumatic brain injury. He had obvious damage to his left temporal lobe and likely also had experienced shearing or micro tears. Doctors, nurses, and rehab specialists told me to grieve my old husband and learn to love the new one. They also urged me to take care of myself, citing statistics about high levels of depression and sickness among caretakers. This is a marathon, not a race, they said. Prepare for a new life. When Christian began waking up, it was agonizingly slow. For weeks, he didn't speak. His family and I weren't sure if he even knew who we were, until one day, He pointed at me from his wheelchair and said to the medical assistant in a raspy voice, "My wife." For Christian's first steps, one aide stood chest to chest with him, talking through the process, while a second held a strap looped around my husband's waist to help him balance. A third aide physically picked up his foot and put it down. Going to the bathroom, brushing teeth, and bathing all took a similar team effort. When Christian finally came home after 3 months, I would look at him across the room and wonder, who is this stranger? My new husband walked and talked differently. He used to be the one who led us confidently on hikes to the backcountry. Now, he got lost on short walks to the grocery store, often turning the wrong way when leaving the house. Always described as laid back and an eternal optimist by those who knew him, he was now quick to anger, especially when his things weren't where he expected them to be. A once successful and busy urban planner, he could no longer do professional work. Nor could he keep pace with carpenters or handymen, jobs he had excelled at previously. Before his accident, he was often the life of the party, cajoling friends into dance competitions. He designed an obstacle course for my birthday, made a glow-in-the-dark hula hoop to use at our annual big group camping trips, and organized 10 grown men to dance to Beyoncé's Single Ladies for my bachelorette party. Now, he tired easily in social situations and would nap in a quiet room or sit with his eyes closed in the corner. Our marriage suffered, mostly because our once shared burdens of work and home now fell so much more on me. But there were also surprising upsides. Early in our relationship, Christian had resisted getting a dog, even though I wanted one, because of how it would tie us down and hamper our travel. Neither of us wanted children, and he'd happily gotten a vasectomy. Now, he expressed a desire for both dogs and children and talked about reversing his vasectomy, making me second-guess my decisions. Eventually, we were able to resume our long bike rides with him on a recumbent tricycle. He lacked the balance for a two-wheeler. He used to ride in front, acting as my windblock guide and protector. Now he trails behind. I look down at his helmet, at the person on the bright yellow recumbent tricycle, and wonder, who is this stranger? His sense of humor has remained more or less intact, if differently delivered. For the first Halloween after his crash, he dressed up as a person with a head injury, wrapping his head in gauze upon which he dribbled red food coloring. Around his neck, he wore a sign that read, "Too soon?" "Yes, too soon," his friend said, but it was funny. What does it mean to grieve someone who is alive, but who walks, talks, thinks, acts, and looks different from before? The experts call this kind of loss ambiguous grief or unconventional grief. People with loved ones who fall prey to Alzheimer's may experience this, as may parents whose children become alcoholics or drug addicts. Naming my grief is helpful because it invites me to engage in rituals of grieving. When I lost my old husband, there was no funeral, no burial, no going through his items to decide what to keep or discard. No questions about when I might consider dating again. I never removed my wedding ring and gazed at my bare finger. I simply carried on, missing my husband and occasionally crying among strangers. My new husband isn't the same person I married, but he has his beauty. I admire so much about him. Having lost the ability to hustle, he enjoys life at a slower pace. Every morning, he sits on the porch with a cup of coffee, chatting with neighbors. Lacking a crisp memory of the past and unable to plan for the future as he once did, he lives in the moment. He meditates regularly on the couch with closed eyes. He rarely complains about anything. He supports others who have experienced brain injury and cares for his aging mother. He enjoys holding our friends' babies, playing with our toddler niece, and spoiling our dachshund with treats and belly rubs. He's already planning next year's Halloween costume. Our 8th wedding anniversary recently passed. The traditional gift is linens and lace, but I decided to create a new ritual that is more fitting for my unconventional grief. On the morning of our anniversary, I sat outside by our fire pit, coffee cup in hand, reflecting. For 18 months, I was married to the old Christian. For 6.5 years, I have been married to the new one. On a small piece of paper, I wrote down what I miss about my old husband. With my basic drawing skills, I sketched him, going no-handed on a bike and confidently starting a new home remodeling project. I described the future I once imagined for us. I burned those pieces of paper in a small fire. On a fresh piece of paper, I wrote, "Welcome." Below that, I jotted down dozens of words and phrases describing my new husband. Doesn't rush. Gets lost, but enjoys the experiences and keeps trying. Revels in simple pleasures. Alongside sketches of him playing with our dog and hanging out with his new friends. That page I didn't burn. I used it to welcome this stranger into my life.
That's Renee Elise Goldsberry reading Megan Horst's essay, "Are You My Husband?" We'll catch up with Megan after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Megan Horst's essay came out in January 2019. When she learned it was going to be published, she shared it with Christian.
he was surprisingly extremely enthused about the article, even though it shares and divulges some of the hardships he faces, and he likes to hide those a lot. But he was surprisingly really happy about the article, and we have a bunch of the printed versions, and he gives it to people. He has framed one of the versions and hung it up in our living room. So I think he's proud of our story being out there and proud of, in his own way, being kind of an ambassador or representative of the TBI community.
TBI stands for traumatic brain injury. And while Megan is proud too, she's also still working on getting past her grief.
I still am dealing with that tension. I think it's going to be one of my life journeys, and maybe it's all of our life journeys, is to accept the things you cannot change and love people for who they are. I do think I have made some progress on that. Even Christian says he thinks I'm more relaxed and accepting, so that's good. I still sort of am coming up with rituals or daily practices that help me on that journey.
And though Megan writes about the ways that Christian changed after his accident, she says that some things also stayed the same.
His personality is not as changed as many people with brain injury can have. Some people have much more severe personality changes, particularly if they have frontal lobe injuries, for example. He has the same sort of snarky, inappropriate sense of humor. He has a lot of the same interests. So in a lot of ways, his personality is very similar. It's just now has this layer of challenge due to his brain injury around it. So it's harder for him to recall the past or think about the future a lot. It's taken us a while to figure out what tools can help him kind of operate more smoothly in the world, show up to appointments on time, remember to let the dogs out, turn the oven off, do his social outings, go to the gym, all the things he wants to do in life.
And Christian's still dealing with his own frustrations, too.
He is a bit more quick to anger and irritability. You know, I suspect a lot of that's because living with a brain injury is really hard. He has many ways of describing it, but one time he's like, it's like doing life, but like having to move through thick mud all the time. So I can see how that would be pretty frustrating day after day.
It's been almost 8 years since Christian's accident. He's 40 now, and Megan is 39. And recently, they crossed a new threshold. They've known each other post-TBI longer than they knew each other before. Megan's been thinking a lot about their relationship since reaching that milestone.
Gosh, in some ways, I'm sort of amazed we've made it this far. There's a lot of things there. A feeling of, like, pride that our relationship has made it this far and that we both continue to support each other, you know, and some sadness about like what could have been and isn't, and some anxiety, I guess, about the future, like what will that hold?
And Megan says she's not sure what their future will look like.
I actually think we may come to a point where we continue to support each other as strong partners, but we may not remain romantic partners or even married into the future. We're talking about it now. And, you know, I think we're in this interesting world where there's a lot of pressure about marriage and supporting people through it. And I think some of that's beautiful and some of it's really hard and not realistic or really stifling for different situations. So anyway, I am exploring figuring out how to continue supporting Christian and receiving support from him, because I don't want to make it sound like it's just a one-way street. He does a lot of amazing things for our partnership. But I think we're going to explore kind of continuing to support each other as husband and wife or as family members or as partners. I'm not quite sure what that will look like, but perhaps with some openings to explore other relationships. So that's still a work in progress. Stay tuned.
In the meantime, Megan says she hopes her story reaches the many families of people with a brain injury and makes them feel understood.
One reality of when your partner has a big issue is most of the attention is focused on the partner. And, you know, even my own family, his family will reach out to me and be like, how's Christian? That's their first and sometimes their only question often, and I totally empathize with or understand that, but sometimes it's nice to, like, when they stop and say, how are you? Like, I'm even kind of tearing up thinking about that right now. So, even just telling them that you know this must be hard for them, I think goes a long way.
That's Megan Horst. She's a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University. More from Renee Elise Goldsberry and Daniel Jones after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Renee Elise Goldsberry.
When I was getting married and choosing my husband, I was very concerned that the person I married had a love for me that would grow, that was bigger than who I was in the moment. I just was very aware that it was absolutely essential that you loved this Renee, but could love anything that I would turn into. What I love so much about this essay is that it's such an example to me of how flexible, how wide, how open, how beautiful, how all-encompassing and far-reaching true love is. When I was thinking about that in my own life, I was imagining like a lifetime of aging. But within 18 months, her entire reality changed, and the person that she loved and looked to changed drastically, and she learned to love this person. And I just think that that is what love is, in our love of each other, in our love of ourselves. We need to be able to grow.
Thanks so much to Renee for reading this week's essay. Her new movie, Waves, is in theaters now. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I'm always interested in essays where a marriage or a relationship starts out as one thing and then often through an accident, sometimes through a traumatic brain injury, just really morphs into a whole new relationship. And the way that the wife and the husband approach this change, for her, rituals are important, grieving is important, and these are all things that have to do with a past and a future and being able to sort of delineate the two and mark that change. And for him, he's really sort of forced to live in the moment. And that's that sort of strange silver lining to this story, that he's not interested in rituals or grieving or marking change. He's interested in friendship and family and hanging out with the dog. And there can often be this sort of strange, sweet upside where resentments fall away and past family battles and tensions fall away. And, you know, remarkably in these stories, there can be an upside if you go looking for it.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and by the way, my other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. So check it out in your podcast feed. We'll see you next week.